Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Herschel, who's Director of the Population and Development Program and a Professor of Development Sociology at Cornell University. His latest book just out is Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Herschel.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And you, along with your co-authors, have been working on this for some time. That's Mark Rank and Herbert Hadley. I take it that you worked through the panel for the panel study of income dynamics, which is the longest-running longitudinal household survey in the world. So you've gathered, what, 41 years' worth of data?
That's correct. We have 41 years worth of data, and we've been looking at these data for about 20 years because they give us a unique perspective on American society, where I think we tend to discuss with our friends and our colleagues maybe the positive side of our lives. And we started noticing when we were analyzing these data that people go through a lot of adverse economic events. And in fact, 80% of the country has some economic adverse event, either unemployment, poverty, or using the safety net at least once between the age of 25 and 60. And about 40% of those people will have it five or more economic adverse events. So we began to see this pattern of we actually have a very economically vulnerable society. And probably most importantly, the vulnerability is increasing over time.
So then how do you relate this to the fact that the rich are getting richer? I mean, is that at the heart of this argument over growing income equality?
What's happening is that the top 10% are getting greater and greater shares of total income, therefore greater and greater shares of accumulated wealth in terms of assets. And so it spills over into political situations where, you know, what the decisions the government makes, strategic decisions about how the economy works, that becomes more under the influence of the wealthy, who then can use money to influence politics. And the average person is with less and less money. So over time, this begins, I think, even to erode our democracy.
So in terms of the panel study on income dynamics, which began at the University of Michigan in 1968, and you have a representative sample of over 18,000 individuals living in 5,000 families.
That's right.
And the information was collected continuously through 1996 and every year after that. And this data covers employment, income, wealth, expenditures, health, marriage, childbearing, child development, philanthropy, education, and numerous other topics. So there's no question, to my mind, Thomas Herschel, that you and your co-authors have done your homework.
Yeah, we worked hard on the data. The data go through 2009, from 1968 until 2009. And we're actually continuing to work on the data. And even after the book is published, we're still writing more papers. And probably we're going to have a second book because there's so much to say about what's happening right now. But we think we have a representative sample. And what we really find is that people can actually have, you know, they can have events in their life which are represent prosperity. They might make a six-figure income for a couple years, and then maybe a decade later they hit a hard spot and they go into poverty. And in fact, we interviewed, besides the data, we also interviewed 70 people, and we conducted 18 focus groups as well to try to get a sense of how people understood their experiences. And when we really started probing people, we found that, yes, those experiences are there. You just kind of have to sort of scratch the surface, and people start talking about the issues. You know, their husband fell off a roof, or they had a medical problem that was very devastating financially. And that really the country is very vulnerable, and that's not really part of the political discourse. Well, Obama started talking about it, I guess, somewhat recently. But that's really there's this myth that we historically have been a middle-class society. And our book kind of goes through that people understand this idea that if they work hard and they play by the rules, they'll get ahead. And that's kind of the dominant thinking of the American people. That's starting to change a little bit, but our book shows that that's still very widespread, that people work hard to try to, you know, do well, and they're diligent, and they expect to do well, and when they don't, they get really upset, which is understandable.
And I guess the real political question is, how does that upset manifest itself? It does seem the Republicans are very good at getting people who are angry to vote, in effect, against their own interest. Rather than blame the plutocrats, they blame the government.
Yes. I mean, I think people... this is something new, especially for white America, to have these kinds of adverse events. And I think the Republicans are trying to play a populist card, and the Democrats are also maybe doing something somewhat similar. But you have little inklings of changes in the country. For example, there's a movement that started in North Carolina called Moral Monday, where people started going down to the courthouse, especially in the state capitol in Raleigh, and protesting the fact that the state is opting out of Medicaid, the extension of Medicaid. They're opting out of long-term unemployment benefits, and that it's very difficult to survive for many families in North Carolina. And they're doing civil disobedience, and already over 1,000 people have been arrested in North Carolina, and it's actually spreading to other southern states. But that sort of thing is representing a new kind of consciousness that's sort of beyond what our book is able to identify in the main aspects of the opinion surveys that we looked at.
Again, I'm speaking with Thomas Herschel, the director of the Population and Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. His latest book just out is Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. And this book finds that a majority of Americans, you say up to 80%, will experience poverty despite the American's dream's promise of a good life that is attainable through hard work and perseverance. So, to my mind, Thomas Herschel, then, this is really a question of what do we do with the information that our reality is at odds with the myth of the American dream and the Horatio Alger idea that through hard work and perseverance you just pull up your bootstraps and you'll make it. And if as it appears to be the case, the system is rigged, I mean, there's nothing more graphic in terms of making that point, at least to my mind, than the one of the heirs to the DuPont fortune, who's sexually molested his own 3-year-old daughter and 18-month-year-old son, gets off, pays a $5,000 fine, and the judge says, suspends his sentence to detention, because of jails would not be good for him. I mean,
jails are not good for the people in jail, that's for sure.
Right, but in other words, because he's rich and privileged, then a jail would be bad for him, so therefore we can't punish him for sexually molesting his own 3-year-old daughter.
Wow, I didn't hear about that, Ian. That's shocking. You know, I think that's kind of where we're headed, is this kind of like, a privileged section of society that's not subject to the same rules as the majority. I mean, the majority of the population is at risk of poverty. And I think that people can deal with this. We can't, the wealth is, the country has the wealth to eliminate poverty. The thing is that we don't really have public discourse that would lead to those, to posing the question in a way that we could begin to solve those problems. I mean, there's kind of an interesting situation in New York State. There's a community that lives up in the Adirondacks, which has very severe winters. And they have kind of a social security system that the community has built, because they understand that they have to take care of themselves just to make it through the winter. So they have a place, it's called a food pantry, but actually they can get blankets and all kinds of supplies, that if someone has a problem, if their house burns down or something, they can go to this community facility and just take the things they need. There's no means testing. It's just done by community consensus. So that's kind of and I've been studying that community for a number of years now in the Adirondacks. And that kind of thing, the people who live there understand that if they acted as individuals, they would be at risk of death, because it's a very sparsely populated area. And if you run out of food, you die very quickly in the cold winter. And so people kind of check up on each other if they don't show up for work or if they don't leave their house at their normal time. And that kind of thinking, I think, is really not part of our middle-class way of life, that we need to start taking care of each other.
Well, that would be, I think, where the division is, isn't it? There, it would seem to me that the Republicans, their strategy is to divide, and particularly along race and gender lines to keep alive issues of homosexuality, etc., and opposition to it, and keep alive issues of race, even though in many ways the upcoming millennial generation have gotten over both of those ideas that these things are a problem. And it would seem to me that, you know, on the one hand, you've got a party that knows how to divide. And the other hand, you've got a party, the Democrats, who don't know how to unite.
Right. I think that's well put, Ian. I think you put that really well. I think that's correct, that American politics from the beginning, especially, were about racial division, coming out of the legacy of, I mean, slavery has been over with for a long time, but the politics of racial division are still very strong in the South. So you have a lot of congressional districts and municipalities that are gerrymandered on the basis of race, and that then spills over into sexuality and gender and all kinds of other things, where people are divided against each other. Instead of trying to understand their needs as part of a community, they see themselves as part of a group or as an individual, or just straight individualism, I think is also a very strong belief that we have in American society. So, you know, I think what's really called for is some new kind of thinking, and we can solve these problems. It's not like this is not rocket science. There's plenty of wealth. There's plenty of technology to take care of the things that we need and to meet our needs, but that can only happen if we pose questions about the collective need.
Well, our previous guest who was giving us an analysis of the Affordable Care Act, you know, the uh-huh. White House is celebrating having 7.1 million people sign up. And what I got out of the discussion was that, you know, the irony that the people who've mostly benefited from the Affordable Care Act so far are people who have not had insurance before, who haven't been able to get it before, and they tend to be poorer, and they may not vote. They, you know, there may not be a payoff. You know, Obama's done the right thing, but there's this expression in America, "Nice guys finish last." You know that he's done the right thing. He's brought at least half of 7.1 million people out, providing them with something that they've desperately needed for decades, if not centuries, and yet. The Republicans are running on the idea of a middle class backlash against this terrible government intrusion into your lives, and there's some evidence that maybe premiums might go up for the middle class. So it seems to me that's a test case in many ways of what is so strange is that we have a kind of hostility to the poor, I guess.
Yes, I think that's correct. We have a bias against the poor, that it's a stigmatized. If you're poor, it's because it's a fault of your own. The people in North Carolina that are in the Moral Monday movement, they really are working very hard to make sure that people are registered, and they have the added impediment that they have to have a state-approved ID to vote in North Carolina now. They have a voting document law. So I think people are getting aware of this, that voting is a very important part of it's one part of the political process of enfranchisement.
Well, there's also a deep feeling out there, though, which certainly around this Pacifica radio network, most of the coverage and political messaging, I would say, if any, is a plague on both their houses. The Democrats and the Republicans there's no difference between the two of them. Either don't vote or vote for meaningless marginal parties like the Greens and the Peace and Freedom. So, you know, there is and it's in many ways justified, a kind of disgust at the two-party system.
Yeah, I think there is. I think that, for one thing, the Republican Party is somewhat shorn of its base because the small businesses, this community is having a very hard time staying afloat in this climate where only the most powerful businesses are really succeeding, the biggest corporations. And the labor unions have really, you know, they're less than 10% of the private workforce or in unions now, which was a key link to the. So I think civil society is really not well connected to either of the parties right now, and they're tending to work on money, just, you know, the money of the wealthy are driving a lot of the
right, problems, which in case people haven't been following the Supreme Court, they just opened the floodgates even further.
Exactly.
For
Yeah.
Yeah. So we know what direction the law is heading in, and the empowerment and added privilege to the plutocracy, as though they were somehow a beleaguered minority who couldn't express themselves on a level playing field. I mean, the whole logic of that is so monstrously distorted. It's mind-boggling.
Right. Right, it kind of fits in with the logic of what's happening economically when you think about the wealth is pyramiding upward, the income is pyramiding upward, and then those are the people that have the most influence over the politics. So then the law is actually changing to facilitate that process. But I think we'll also begin to see sort of a mobilization from below where people understand they have to. You have a group like the Move to Amend, which is trying to amend the Constitution to take money out of politics. So the reverse is also beginning to happen now, and I think that's really important that people are developing these new understandings that we need not just to get new candidates, but we need to reform the whole political process.
Well, just in closing, Thomas Herschel, some months back, the Associated Press ran a story based upon the research that you and your co-authors have done, that was a preview of this new book that you've done, Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. And it was a real shock and a wake-up to most Americans that up to 80% of Americans at some point in their lives experience poverty, and that in the land of opportunity, there's a real dark side and a growing recognition that the playing field is not level, and you can't make it just through hard work and perseverance, and that the game is rigged against you. So what are you hoping is the takeaway for people who get your book, which presumably they should?
Well, our book really has a lot of hopeful stories in it, because we interview people who are really serious about having an optimistic view, being not just optimistic about their own lives, but being optimistic in terms of their loved ones, their families, providing a foundation, a better future for their children. And we think, the American people are very energetic and optimistic, but at the same time, we need to kind of shift gears. Our kind of editorializing on the data at the end is kind of like, well, we need new ideas, new organizations to really achieve the American dream for more and more people, for everyone. I mean, there's this rhetoric of our culture, freedom for all, and the Pledge of Allegiance, justice for all. Well, it's never really been justice for all or freedom for all. It's always been restricted to, sometimes by gender, almost always by race. But we can begin to have those things if we start to look more broadly. And we believe that really, by looking at ourselves and seeing who we are and what we can achieve, if we can develop new ideas and new organizations, we can get there. So we feel like even though the country is kind of heading in the wrong direction, the answers are implicit in the reasons for that.
So in other words, it shouldn't only be the rich who can pursue happiness.
Yeah, everybody. That's right. We have a technology now. We have computers and biotech and ways of producing things that are marvelous, and we just need to kind of get them to work in the public interest.
Well, Thomas Herschel, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Herschel, who's the director of the Population Development Program and a professor of development sociology at Cornell University. His latest book just out is Chasing the American Dream, Understanding What Shapes Our Fortunes. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Yeah.